Hey, future Unnaturalists, I'm Emily.
And I'm Andy.
And we are the hosts of Unnatural, a True Crime Podcast.
Each week, we'll dive into some of the most unnerving crimes that this unnatural world has to offer.
Listen for Unnatural on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, make good choices.
And don't get got.
Bye.
Yeah. You don't need my permission.
Hell no.
Hi, friends. I'm Dee Dee West.
And I'm Summer.
And this is Broken Limelight. We're going to start our episode about the murder of Gianni Versace. So this is going to be at least a two-part episode, and we'll get more into Versace's murder in the second part, because he was obviously the last one that was killed before the manhunt got real. But this is going to be fun because it's going to be one of those psychological ones where we're going to deep dive into the victimology and his whole MO and everything.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this because Summer actually didn't know that he was killed by a serial killer.
No, I didn't.
So I'm excited to we're going to get her firsthand reaction here. Also, you guys hear me talk about Ryan Murphy shows all the time, but he did the American Crime Story, the one that he did also an episode about Monica Lewinsky, or I'm sorry, a season about Monica Lewinsky. You know how I love a good docudrama. I love my TV shows. But he did like a fascinating show about Gianni Versace. I mean, it's the same show, American Crime Story. The assassination of Gianni Versace, because the way he frames it is that it's kind of like political in nature. And you'll find out that it's because Gianni Versace was openly gay, and so was his killer, Andrew Cunanan. And that kind of becomes a major theme in this.
Oh, that's really interesting.
You just wait.
I'm excited.
So another big source for this episode is the book Vulgar Favors by Maureen Orth. So just to give you a little bit of background, Gianni Versace was shot and killed in 1997 out in front of his mansion in Miami by Andrew Cunanan. And it's unclear if Versace had any connection to this man or if there was any motive whatsoever. Interestingly, Maureen Orth, who is a reporter for Vanity Fair, had already been following a string of murders and doing her own independent investigation into Andrew Cunanan, because he had already murdered four people. So she is taking her own personal notes on this guy and digging into him when all of a sudden she gets this phone call. Gianni Versace just got murdered and we think it's your guy.
Oh.
So she's got this whole like book full of notes on this guy. And meanwhile, the police were doing a terrible job.
So they didn't take it serious until Versace was murdered.
Yeah, basically. I mean, we'll get to it, but we'll find out that it probably could have been stopped sooner. I'll put it that way. Before I keep going, I just want to make an announcement. Earlier this month, I had posted something on Facebook about Carlos Santana. He collapsed at a performance. And there were like no updates after that. He just collapsed. And he's an older gentleman now. So I was curious one of these days and I looked it up. It turns out that he's fine now. It was a case of like overheating and exhaustion. He had been working all day and it's hot as balls right now. So he got treatment and he's fine now. He's back to work. So I just want to let everybody know he's good. Thank goodness. I don't want to lose him yet, you know?
Right.
Not like that.
Yeah. Also, I saw that Jason Momoa was in a head-on collision.
I literally,
as I was getting on my computer to get on here, like the news article was on there and I was like, oh no, not my husband.
When today? Sorry, when you said head-on collision, for some reason, I'm thinking you're telling me the title of a movie. I'm like, okay.
You're like, never heard of her.
I know. Sorry. Yeah, that's sad. Is he okay? Was that just today?
Jason Momoa accident. I'm Googling it. 1 second. Motorcycle crash video shows aftermath of accident. He was in a head-on collision with a motorcyclist.
Ooh, wait, what? Was he in a car? Sorry. Sounds like Jason Momoa is fine.
Yeah, I think he's fine because everybody would be like crying on Facebook. Jason Momoa appeared uninjured after he was involved in a scary head-on collision with a motorcycle this week near Calabasas.
That's scary. All right, you ready? We took like a moment of silence there. Oh, yeah. So sorry. There's one more thing I wanted to say about Maureen Orth, the writer of this book. There are a handful of people that don't think she is a reputable source. And I'll tell you this, though. They tend to be Woody Allen supporters. apparently she wrote a report on him and people are just like, lies. So I think they just didn't like the thing she said. And I think that's funny because people, Maureen and I have that in common. I mean, with that said, I believe she is a reputable reporter. So I'm sorry if you don't. But in this case, I really think she's, I don't think there's anybody better to ask. So just a little bit about Gianni Versace. He was an Italian fashion designer, socialite, and businessman. He was the founder of Versace, an international luxury fashion house that produces accessories, fragrances, makeup, home furnishing, and clothing. His clothing was known for being like especially sexy and risque. He also designed costumes for theater and films. He was a friend of Eric Clapton's, Princess Diana, Naomi Campbell, Kate Moss, Madonna, Elton John, and Tupac Shakur, and a lot of other celebrities. He was one of the first designers to link fashion to the music world. So like I said, this is a long episode and it's going to dive mostly into Andrew Cunanan in part one. So we will get more into Versace a little bit later. So Andrew Cunanan was born on August 31st, 1969 in National City, California to his parents, Modesto Pete Dungao Cunanan, who was a Filipino-American, and his mother, Mary Ann Shalacy, an Italian-American. Mary Ann was the child of immigrant parents. Her mother died when she was 19, and she moved to California to live with her brother, but she got the feeling that she wasn't welcome there. Apparently, she and her brother were really affectionate for brother and sister, and her brother's wife got like uncomfortable by it. So at that time, she met Pete, who was a Filipino immigrant who was enlisted in the U.S. Navy. As soon as he got to the United States, he says that he came straight from the Philippines and then joined the Navy.
Interesting.
I guess. Yeah, he was like handsome and confident and he walked with like a swagger and he had this big booming voice like he demanded attention. So when Mary Ann saw him for the first time in a bar, her heart just stopped and they spent the whole night dancing. So they got married and they ended up having four children. Their first child was named Christopher. Mary Ann was 6 months pregnant when they got married. Then they had a daughter named Elena who was blonde haired and blue eyed and Pete instantly suspected that she wasn't his daughter. So Pete ended up developing an attitude of total disgust towards Mary Ann, and he became super abusive towards her. He was for sure verbally and emotionally abusive, and while he claims that he never got physical, Mary Ann says that he pulled her by her hair and he did strike her on multiple occasions. He was also a very strict disciplinarian. For example, if the kids were watching TV or like playing in the living room and Pete walked in, like he came in from work, the kids just immediately vacated the room so that he could sit down and eat his dinner alone in front of the TV.
Oh, wow.
Mary Ann ended up becoming kind of fragile and dependent. She made sure the house was absolutely spotless per his orders, putting plastic liners on everything. She was also Catholic and strictly religious. It was said that she was kind of eccentric and would often say the first thing that popped into her head in like a childlike voice. At the same time, she was kind of passive aggressive and manipulative. Like, for example, she was known to use sex to get Pete to buy her new furniture.
In her baby voice.
You're funny.
We need a new couch.
No, that's not even it.
That's pretty good.
I want a floral print.
Money was a huge source of tension between them. Pete seemed to find a lot of importance in social etiquette. He needed to hold a reputation as a classy, cultured, and wealthy man, so he liked to splurge on fancy things, even when he couldn't afford it. But Pete says that Mary Ann, who was a stay-at-home mom, was actually the one who was spending money like crazy. And she kind of was, like, she was taking as much money because she liked the lifestyle, too. So she was spending all this money on her kids as much as she could. And for reference, Pete had three bank accounts and Mary Ann only had access to one of them. Despite their marital troubles, they had two more kids, Regina and Andrew. They purchased their first home in 1967 for $12,500 in a scruffy little town in National City. Andrew was born in 1969 and his birth was really traumatic for Mary Ann. She lost a lot of blood and fell into a deep postpartum depression, and she wasn't able to take care of herself or the baby, so she ended up getting hospitalized for 3 months, leaving Pete to take care of the newborn, Andrew. Pete bonded a lot with this baby. From the beginning, he knew that the baby was exceptional. Pete says that Andrew never cried, and even one time he stepped on a hot coal and didn't make a peep.
A hot bowl?
Coal.
Oh. Like, I don't, I feel like I know a little bit about Filipino, you know, culture, but
he was here in California.
Still, I don't know.
Yeah. So he stepped on a hot coal and I guess didn't make a peep. And Pete was like, this child is exceptional. I don't know. To me, that sounds like he's raising a little psychopath.
He's like, you're not a pussy. I like it.
Right. He's just like, look at this child. He never cries.
I love him.
I can do this to him.
That my wife awful. Should be more like him.
Ooh, that was bad. When Andrew was 3, Pete retired from the Navy with a full pension and he started pursuing his dream to become a stockbroker. I mean, his dream was actually to be filthy fucking rich. So he got a bachelor's degree and then a master's degree for business administration. Around this time, Marianne inherited some money and considered using it to start a new life without Pete. But instead, she ended up using it to buy a bigger house with Pete co-signing. So they bought a 3-bedroom house in a nice, affluent neighborhood. That's how you felt, say it. Affluent.
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 Affluent. Affluent. I don't know.
Affluent.
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 They like the part.
A nice neighborhood. And called La Jolla, and the house cost $96,000. So this was a big step up for the family. Marianne would say that Chris and Elena were from a different time from Andrew and Gina, saying that they were street kids.
Oh.
They grew up differently in like the scruffy little town, National City. And then like they were all pinching pennies. And then Andrew and Regina were born into this family when Pete was a stockbroker making money, living in this nice neighborhood, and the kids were given everything they wanted while Chris and Elena were not raised that way. Still, the family wasn't rich, but they made sure that Andrew specifically had everything that the rich kids did have. Andrew was known to do really well academically. He read the Bible and memorized the encyclopedia by age 10. He took an IQ test in third grade and scored 147, but his teachers still didn't think he was like spectacularly intelligent or anything. But his parents did, and that was enough. I'm guessing what it was that Andrew probably just didn't use it in school. Like he didn't do his work or anything. He wasn't an exceptional student, maybe.
Right.
For me, what it feels like is maybe he's good at memorizing facts too. That kind of thing makes you seem really smart, you know?
Like a savant.
Mm-hmm. He was a calm, quiet kid, and he would often retreat into books while the other kids played outside. A neighbor from his childhood calls him the epitome of a mama's boy. And he recalls that one time he called him outside to play. And when Andrew came to the door, Marianne pulled him inside and was like, you can't do that. So he was like really sheltered.
Yeah, that's to not even let him go outside and play. That's pretty sheltered. You're not a street kid.
Oh. Andrew and his mother had a pretty close relationship, but it was kind of odd. It was like Marianne and Pete were competing for Andrew's attention. Marianne brags that she and Andrew were inseparable when he was a little boy. And this infuriated Pete. He would say, you cannot cling like that to your son. Pete was also noted as saying, she suffocated him by his necktie. She clung to his belt loop. It was that kind of relationship, mothering in a different way. Maureen Orth wrote that Marianne was helping create a personality who began to see himself as superior, which his father encouraged. Andrew and Pete's relationship was odd too, with pet names and using baby talk well into Andrew's teenage years.
That's creepy.
Yeah. So Andrew was clearly treated superiorly to the other kids, and this kind of cemented the idea in his mind that he was superior. One of his classmates in junior high said, the one impression I got from Andrew back then is he knew something good would happen to him. He knew he would turn out better than his peers, better than everyone around him. This sense of superiority was his defining characteristic. Andrew's father also like trained him to be like this very cultured and eloquent person. It basically just like taught him how to know how to speak to rich people and fit in with them. He would take him out for ice cream and tutor him on labels and image. And he would offer to buy him all kinds of crap. Like he would point out these nice shoes and a blazer and be like, you like this? Let's get you this. Like no matter how expensive it was. And he just wasn't doing that same kind of thing for the other kids. He couldn't afford this. So Andrew learned quickly that his dad would literally buy him anything. It was like having the idea of having to afford something wasn't a concept to him. They could literally walk around and point to something and it would get bought for him. So if there were financial issues, he just wasn't aware of them. He only knew of instant gratification.
Right. It appeared that they had everything that they needed.
At least he did. It was like he never even had to conceive of anybody else. Like it didn't make sense, you know? He like snapped his finger and he had things. By the time Andrew was in 7th grade, he had already developed a taste for finer things. He attended a classmate's 12th birthday party, and he was disappointed that there was only tap water and no Perrier. He started telling these grandiose and highly embellished stories, something that he must have also gotten from his father. Pete would often tell these life stories about working for Merrill Lynch in Manila and owning a plantation and just like all these tall tales created to make him seem successful.
Hmm.
Andrew made friends with a pair of twins named Matthew and Rachel Riffat, I think, who were intelligent and well-traveled, and he would spend a lot of weekends over at their house. He even let them meet his parents, which was something he like never did. He never let people over to his house or like his parents come to the school for any reason. He didn't let anybody see his real life. So then the one time that they did meet his parents, the twins, it was like very staged. He greeted his mom by throwing his arms up around her and saying, "Mama," and blowing her kisses. And she says that he would brag about how she was better than the other mothers, who he called phonies. But nobody who knows Andrew actually believes that, because Andrew treated his mom like garbage. He treated her like a little baby. The twins' mother, Anne, said he'd come into the kitchen and talk to me. He treated Marianne like a child. Little mother, he would call her.
That's so weird, especially because of how close they supposedly were. Maybe she just allowed it to get to that point.
Yeah, I'm thinking that his father convinced him, like, your mother's crazy, you know that.
Yeah. You know? Well, she also, like, talked like a baby, so I don't know.
Yeah, but so did him and his father.
That's true.
With their little pet names and shit.
Such a weird dynamic.
Super weird. There was another friend of Andrew's from school named Stacy Lopez, who he told about his family. He told her that his mother was a mess, and he talked about his siblings being jealous of him. She says that he couldn't bring himself to tell his parents that he was gay, even though he wanted the rest of the world to know it. He was known to love money and love having older men take care of him when he was just 16. She didn't think he prostituted himself, but just like maybe let guys take him out and like make him look good, you know, and like they would buy him presents in exchange.
He was a sugar baby.
Yeah, from the age of 16.
That's crazy.
But it's unclear if he was actually having sex with them or not. One time, one of his sugar daddies bought him a bright red leather suit and he flaunted it at school. It was the kind of thing that nobody would dare wear, like, in that day and age. Like, if you were gay, it was, like, shy, you know?
Yeah,
and he was in your face. He also started, like, introducing this aspect of danger. Like, he really liked to call attention to himself. He started bringing a gun to school, often keeping it in his car and just, like, taking it out to show to people. On his senior class ski trip, he was accused of stealing money from a condo where all of his friends were staying. He denied it and nothing was ever proven, but people continued to wonder. He started regularly saying that his two favorite things were sex and taking a shit. His gestures and laughter were said to become like edgy. And his friend Matthew said that he would do things a little bit too aggressively, like slap him on the back or grab him in or grab his arm in a way that was like jarring.
Mm.
This is a little excerpt from the book Vulgar Favors. It is from a psychologist who lived next door to Andrew and befriended him. Her name was Elizabeth Oglesby. She said, "Narcissists look at people as objects they can consume or use. His parents were just there to serve, adore, or cater to him. It's not unusual, according to psychotherapists who have studied narcissism, that in unhappy families, the mother may choose a son to lavish her attention on and may use him almost as an emotional stand-in for the husband who has rejected her. While their loyalties are torn between their parents, they are taught that they are superior, little prince charmings. Yet, they are not able to process such feelings of intimacy, so they end up pushing down their confused feelings of guilt, fear, or anger, and eventually what's left is a coldness and an idea that one's image is more important than having feelings at all. The explosion comes later when the child is unable to get his way, then the image crumbles and all the pent-up rage erupts."
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Doesn't it?
That's like the definition of their family.
Yeah, it explains them like perfectly. Also, they actually did call him the little prince. Like his parents would call him the little prince and his brother and sister would be like, "Well, Andrew's the little prince. Like he got everything."
Wow.
By high school, Andrew was a full-on snob. Pete was working as a stockbroker and he wasn't doing too well. He left one job after 2 years and then was fired from the next job after about a year, but he continued to blow through his money. He enrolled Andrew in a prestigious school called the Bishop School, and it was not cheap. At the time when Andrew was enrolled, the annual tuition was $4,000 to $6,000. Very few students received financial aid, and the ones that did got about $1,500, so there was still like a huge bill left to pay. And all of this on Pete's occasional income, which never exceeded $50,000 annually, it really put them in trouble. Because he was also spending on other shit, too. Like, he wanted Andrew to have everything he wanted.
Right.
His siblings did not get the same opportunity to go to this school.
That's so odd to me that people treat their children so differently from one another.
I've heard of like not that, not to excuse it, but to give it context, like the daughter that he thinks isn't his, like, okay, maybe, but he still has two other kids that he doesn't spoil, and it doesn't make sense to me. Like, I really wonder what made Andrew so exceptional to him.
Right.
In school, Andrew liked to dress really formally. Like, he would wear suits or preppy jackets. He liked to be flashy and get noticed. He was known to speak in a loud, boisterous tone, which he probably did as a form of getting people's attention. And he probably got that from his father. He was super fashionable and flamboyant, but he was very careful to keep his family life and his social life separate. So his father to this day denies that Andrew is homosexual. He was popular because his stories were funny and colorful, and he liked to talk about fashion and celebrity. So he was popular with the girls. And sometimes his stories were clearly bullshit, but they were so like fun and entertaining to listen to that people would just like stick around and laugh at him, not at him, like with him.
Right.
Some of his classmates recalled that he was fun to watch, kind of like a disaster you can't look away from. In the yearbook, he was named most likely to be remembered, which is exactly what he wanted. He never really had any ambitions, just to be known for his personality and who he was rather than doing anything.
Huh. So he had like no actual goals. He just wanted to be seen and heard.
Exactly. That was his goal. He upheld this rich boy act that was so extra. Like one time he made his mom bring him lobster to school so he could eat it for lunch. And he told her that it had to be there right on time. And it was. Which tells me that Andrew was beginning to adopt a disturbing attitude towards his mother from Pete. One of Andrew's classmates said that he finally stopped being friends with Andrew because he became obnoxious and materialistic and constantly put people down. I picture him like a mean girl.
Yeah, literally. Actually, it's funny because I went to school with a guy who was like just a really flamboyant, mean gay guy.
So by now, Andrew's keeping a lot of secrets. He's trying to create the illusion that his life is perfect. But the reality was that he was hiding his sexuality at home, dealing with a dysfunctional family with an abusive father and an unstable mother. And he's got a lot of elaborate lies to keep up with. But his sense of superiority kept growing. Despite their financial problems, Marianne and Pete mortgaged their home and rented it out in order to buy a new house that was $190,000. It had four bedrooms and Marianne called it a mansion. Andrew was given the master bedroom. Marianne slept in the maid's room and Pete slept on the couch. Andrew was also given his own credit card, which he tapped out quickly. By the time Andrew graduated high school, Pete was cycling through a series of jobs and reportedly shady deals to combat his growing debt. He was accused of embezzling money from his clients at his last job, including a 90-year-old woman, and he was cleaning everybody out. Essentially, he was selling non-existent stocks and pocketing the money.
Oh, shit. Do we know that if he was abusive towards Andrew still or just everyone else?
That's something that I constantly wonder about. Or even, this is just me, maybe even sexual or something.
Right.
You know, some kind of weird favoritism towards him. And like, maybe you'll get the same vibe later when you learn about like Andrew and what he's like sexually, because that's kind of what made me wonder about him. So Pete's job started to notice what he was doing and they got suspicious and the police got involved and Pete fled. He literally abandoned the family and he went to the Philippines and then he sold their house that they were living in out from under them.
Oh my God.
Yeah, his wife and his four kids.
That's insane. He's like, well, it was great. Bye.
For real. And they had no idea what was going on. He had no idea that he didn't have money. So Marianne was left with nothing. She had like $700 to her name. And the only income she had was a $650 pension check from Keith's Navy pension. He also got mad at her for keeping the money for her and the kids to survive, saying that it was actually meant for Andrew's education.
Oh, okay.
Marianne's mental health was deteriorating and she was regularly threatening to commit suicide. So her two older kids, Christopher and Elena, ended up dropping out of school to go take care of her. College. They were in college.
Oh, wow.
Afterwards, Andrew flew to the Philippines and tracked down his father, where he found him living in squalor. This experience shattered Andrew. His father raised him to believe that status was everything, and now his father was living with nothing and left them with nothing. So Andrew's self-worth, which was directly tied to his status, was completely obliterated. Andrew had a friend named Liz Cody, and she offered to let him live with her and her fiance in Berkeley. which was basically right next door to the most liberated gay community in America, called the Castro District in San Francisco. Andrew spent most of his time here in gay bars, but interestingly, he wasn't exactly out of the closet with Liz and his fiance, Phil, for some reason, because he wanted the whole world to know he was gay and flamboyant, except his parents, and for some reason, Liz and Phil. I don't know why. So he kept his dating life private from them, too.
I wonder if they just had, like, vocal opinion about gay people that made him uncomfortable or, like, scared to come out.
Who knows? When Andrew would go out to the clubs and meet people, he would make up these elaborate stories about himself. He claimed that his parents lived on Fifth Avenue and that he had been married and had a daughter. And he actually had a picture of Liz and her daughter, and he would show it to people and say, "This is my ex-wife and my daughter." He also said that his wife was a Jewish princess. He used numerous aliases, like he went by Andrew De Silva the most. He also pretended to be Jewish himself. Super weird. He would say things like, "We have to celebrate Hanukkah." And like one time his friend pulled out a $100 bill to pay a bartender, and Andrew snatched it out of his hand and was like, "This is my Hanukkah present."
Oh. Oh my goodness.
The entitlement, you know?
Right, exactly.
So here's where Versace ties in just a little bit. In October 1990, Versace came to San Francisco with his partner, Antonio D'Amico, to see the opera Capriccio, for which Versace had designed the costumes. The two of them were openly gay, and they enjoyed frequenting these gay bars and hanging out in the gay community. And the whole town was like a buzz when they heard that he was coming to town. So they hit up a disco called Colossus, and Andrew happened to be there that same night. Possibly, because like Andrew's full of shit. And some people attest that he was there, that they saw him there and everything, and they had a conversation with him, while others, like Versace's family, was like, there is no proof that they actually met.
Right, exactly.
So the story goes like this. Andrew had a friend named Eli who was given passes to the Colossus VIP room, and he invited Andrew. Andrew claimed that he had been to Italy a bunch of times and that he had actually met Versace before. This was untrue. But then Gianni Versace happened to see Andrew and approached him and said, "I know you. Lago di Como, no?" According to Maureen Orth, this was just the line that Versace used when he wanted to strike up a conversation with someone. But Andrew saw an opportunity and was like, "That's right. Thank you for remembering, Signor Versace." And then he told everybody this embellished story saying, "And then I said, if you're Gianni Versace, then I'm Coco Chanel." So Andrew's friend Liz and her fiance Phil also recall how Andrew jumped on their bed in the morning shouting, "You'll never believe who I went clubbing with last night," and repeated the Coco Chanel joke. He told everybody this fucking joke. Again, Versace's family denies that they ever met. In the summer of 1991, Liz and Phil decided to move to Sacramento. So Andrew had to go live with his mom again in a two-bedroom apartment in Rancho Bernardo and re-enrolled in the University of California, San Diego. He had to get a job at a Thrifty's drugstore to make ends meet, which was not something he was happy about. Living with his mom also really got to him. She was pretty eccentric and she talked a lot. She also smoked a lot and she threatened suicide often. Their neighbor, Hal Melowitz, a psychiatric social worker who befriended Marianne, remembers that she was under psychiatric care and suffered several nervous breakdowns, the first at the age of 39 when Pete broke a chair over her.
Oh my God.
I know. Andrew seemed totally indifferent towards his mother. He would party for days at a time and then come home to crash, and he demanded that she remain absolutely silent while he slept, no matter what time it was or how late into the afternoon it was. He wouldn't allow her to go to the Thrifty drugstore where he worked, and he would literally fly into a rage if she showed up. She would make him whatever he wanted to eat, even if she only had $15 and he wanted steak for dinner.
I was going to say that sounds like a typical Italian mom.
Yeah, but probably Pete beat her into doing that shit, you know?
Yeah, that's crazy.
He pretty much would come home, eat and do his personal stuff and then go back out to party, which is sad. Like, he's a lot like his father. He never sat down to talk to her or to ask her how she was feeling. And yet whenever he would stop at home, she clung to him and she would ask him, "Well, do you want to eat something? Well, when are you coming back?" Like, she was just desperate to have him spend time with her.
Yeah, that's so sad.
Their neighbor, Elizabeth Oglesby, the psychologist, says that he confided in her, although he also made up a lot of stories. He didn't tell the truth about his parents, but he did tell her that he didn't get along with them, and he basically rejected them. One time in 1993, he lost his temper and slammed his mother against the wall so hard that she fractured her shoulder and had to wear her arm in a sling. When she went to the emergency room, Andrew allegedly warned her that if she told anybody, he would kill her.
Oh my God.
Despite all the violence, Marianne clung to him. According to the other neighbor, Mellowitz, you need a crowbar to pry her away from her son. Andrew began befriending older men at gay clubs and also reportedly making violent pornography. He was using drugs like crystal meth, and apparently crystal meth is big among the gay community, especially in San Diego in the 90s. It was also popular among porn stars, from what I read, and it can keep you having sex or thinking about sex all day long.
Oh, wow.
Andrew also watched a lot of porn, and he tried to work as a porn star. Apparently, that was considered like an ultimate celebrity to him. Like, in a way, it proved that you're attractive.
Oh, because people want to fuck you?
Exactly. He became well-known in the gay nightlife and basically lived off of selling drugs and letting older men take him out and spoil him. When he did have money, he would flash it and buy rounds for everybody. He was super show-offy. And he was also so classy and charming and educated and cultured. And he was pretty attractive. Like, not super attractive, but attractive enough. So these older men just loved bringing him to events and showing him off at parties. It was said that Andrew was also like a middleman, kind of helping the older closeted men hook up with younger men.
Oh, so he was like a madame as well.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, enough, like friendship wise, you know, like he wasn't really taking money from it. He was just kind of like, I think he liked the respect, you know, everybody knew him and everybody needed him.
Right.
Among these older men was a guy named Lincoln Aston, who was a wealthy 60-year-old architect who had once been married and had an attraction to younger men. Andrew and his friend Robin started hanging out with a circle of prominent older gay men and going to cocktail parties and dinner parties with them. And some of them would catch on that Andrew couldn't possibly have done all the things that he had claimed. Like, he literally couldn't have been alive long enough to accomplish all the things he claimed.
Right.
Andrew befriended a young salesman who told them where he could get a job as a male escort. So Andrew went to Florida and did just that. Now, this might be a coincidence, but this particular salesman had clients who were executives of the Home Shopping Network headquartered in St. Petersburg, Florida. One of Andrew's victims later on, his name was Lee Miglin, and he had a wife named Marilyn who was associated with the Home Shopping Network. And Lee helped her run her business in the early 90s. It's not known for sure if Andrew personally knew Lee Miglin or not. It might just be a coincidence.
Huh, that's really interesting.
So Marianne found all these expensive clothes in Andrew's closet with the tag still on them. And she was baffled to see like $700 suits and $300 shoes when Andrew didn't even have a job. So like, she found all these matchbooks from clubs and bars and she called them up and they told her straight up that they were gay clubs. But she was in absolute disbelief and denial. Like, she was in total denial that her son could be gay. Andrew did have legitimate friends, though. Like, he had a little clique that he hung out with because Andrew was the life of the party and he knew everybody. He was really popular in every room he was in. He was the one who everybody wanted to talk to. But those who knew him best knew that Andrew was pretty full of shit. They noticed that he was always driving around in other people's cars and he was staying at different people's houses, but he never made like friendly conversation about these people or who they were.
You know what's funny? Have you seen that show? What is it? Making Anna?
Inventing Anna.
Inventing Anna. Yeah, this is like the male version of that.
You know what? That's a good point. Sorry. That's a good point. I didn't even think about it. He really is like inventing Anna. So like, Andrew's friends would just allow him to live in his fantasy world without challenging him, because if they did, he would just become obnoxious and push with his stories. And then he would eventually become pouty. Pouty. That didn't sound right, did it?
Powy. Powwow.
Powy.
Pow pow.
In effect, this basically made every single person in Andrew's life an enabler.
Pretty much. But he like forced them to be. He was like, you're going to enable me or I'm just going to be really mean to you. And I'm going to slap you on your back.
Or
really
annoying.
Hard. Yeah, annoying as fuck.
I'm not going to shut up about it. So you might as well believe it.
Pretty much.
So around late 1992, early 93, Andrew met a guy named Jeff Trail. Jeff was a former Navy officer and had been struggling with his homosexuality and his sense of identity. He grew up in an all-American kind of family, and being gay in the military wasn't easy in the early days of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So Jeff and Andrew met, and they were both in awe of each other. Not in a sexual way, they were just friends, but Jeff was kind of in awe of how flamboyant and carefree Andrew was, and Andrew really admired Jeff with his uniform and his classy upbringing. So Andrew would introduce Jeff to all kinds of cute boys, which was helpful considering Jeff was still pretty in the closet. So his meeting with boys was very underground.
And by boys, you mean just like 20-year-olds?
His own age, yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that's how they were like, oh my God, that boy is so cute. What a cute boy, you know?
Right.
So Jeff started coming to terms with the fact that he was gay, and he started pulling in guys left and right. And it's because he was legitimately a nice and charming man, and he was such a gentleman that people were so attracted to him. Jeff's career interest was drifting more in the direction of law enforcement, so he bought himself a gun, and he and Andrew, who had a fascination with guns, would go target shooting together. But there was one thing that Jeff didn't tolerate, and that was drugs. And everybody knew that Andrew sold drugs, and that's literally how he got all his money. And they tried to tell Jeff, but Jeff always backed him up because Andrew would lie to him about where his money came from, and he would claim that it was from his parents or something. And the more that people tried to warn Jeff, he would be like, look, I know, but I can't just leave him out in the cold. He looks up to me. He would tell people that Andrew was somebody that, like, you might not like him all the time, but you're still always going to stand by him, kind of like how you would with a brother. Right. Jeff was a ride or die.
He was a military man. They all are.
Yeah, you're right. He was very loyal. What people didn't know at first was that Andrew was not just selling drugs, he was also using them. He was a habitual user of crystal meth, as well as marijuana, cocaine, and prescription downers like Vicodin, Xanax, or Valium. He kept this very, very private, but those who hung out with him a lot did notice that he was like really hyper a lot of times, and then he would like crash at other times, and then he would come back up. Okay, so a little bit ago, I mentioned that Andrew hung out with an older gentleman named Lincoln Aston. I don't know if the two of them ever hooked up because they were both pretty private about their love life like that, but they did hang out in the night scene for sure. They would go to clubs together and go to dinners together. While hanging out with Lincoln Aston, Andrew was introduced to a man named Norman Blanchard, and they begin a relationship in 1994. Norman Blanchard was basically his sugar daddy, but he didn't seem to get much sugar. Norman was 58 and soft-spoken, conservative, and very, very rich. Norman lived in Phoenix, but he had a condo in La Jolla, so he would go visit Andrew often. Norman had actually just recently lost his partner of 26 years to AIDS. Aww. Andrew's friends would say that he thoroughly researched Norman and his sources of money.
That's so sad.
Yeah, it is.
Are you going to tell me that he kills these people?
Not yet. Well, yeah.
I mean, like, I'm not going to tell you that yet.
But yeah, there's a reason I'm telling you about these people. Sorry, spoiler, Andrew's a serial killer.
Fucking asshole.
Norman was cautious with money by nature, which was frustrating to Andrew. He let him move in with him and spoiled him with an allowance of $2,500 a month. He took him on fancy vacations, he gave him lavish gifts and basically anything he wanted, ensuring that Andrew could live any lifestyle he wanted. Unfortunately, Andrew was entitled as fuck and started demanding things like his own place and his own car. And realistically, Andrew wasn't offering much to the relationship. They slept in separate beds, so they didn't have sex. I mean, that's debatable. Some people believe they did have a sexual relationship, but most don't. Like, they really did have two separate twin beds.
So basically, he was just using him for his money and stringing him along.
And I think this guy did like having him on his arm because Andrew was so classy and cultured. He was basically like a tour guide who was good looking and made Norman look good.
Mm-hmm.
It probably was fun for Norman. Still, Andrew would complain to his friends that Norman was cheap. Like, he basically let Andrew decorate their home, and like, he let Andrew tell him what to buy all the time and like where they were going to take their trips. But Norman didn't like to take first class or business class, for example. He liked to take coach. But he fucking would take him to like $5,000 hotels then, you know?
Right.
Norman just wasn't frivolous like Andrew was. He actually wanted to pay for Andrew's education or his career. He gladly would have paid for Andrew to put his brain power and his talent to work, but Andrew was not interested. He wasn't just greedy. He was also pretty lazy.
Well, yeah. And we already know that he had like zero ambition to be anything.
Right. In early 1995, their mutual older friend, Lincoln Aston, seemed to be becoming skeptical about Andrew. He was heard saying, that guy would have to be at least 10 years older than he says he is in order to do all the things he says he's done. And he was also warning people to avoid Andrew. In May of 1995, Lincoln Aston was murdered. The official story is that he was murdered by a male hustler, but there are a few people who believe that Andrew may have been involved with it. Later on, Andrew got Norman to buy him his own place, and coincidentally, maybe, this new place happened to belong to Lincoln Aston.
What?
Yeah. And that's, again, the official story is that some other guy came forward and admitted to killing him. But yeah.
So was Norman and Lincoln friends, or was it the only link? Oh, okay.
No, they were all friends. That's the thing. Okay. They definitely knew each other and they all hung out together.
Because I'm sitting here wondering, like, did they have mutual properties? How?
No, that's, I don't think so. No. It was literally like Andrew would like point to this like little valley or this little mountaintop and was like, I really would love to have a condo up there. I need that condo up there. And then one day Norman bought it for him. Doesn't seem like he knew that was Lincoln's place.
Wow.
I could be wrong.
God. What if he killed him just to have that house?
I don't know. Like I said, so somebody else came forward. That's what's so weird about it. But well, anyway, let's move on, because we'll
confessions all the time.
I know, and I wonder why. But unless it's somebody, you know how people will go down for something because they're already going down for something else.
Yeah, like trying to get a plea deal or something.
Okay, jot that down, and we'll look it up for part two. So Andrew moved into Norman's condo in 1995, leaving his mother high and dry. That November, Pete suddenly stopped having his pension checks sent to her, saying that they were intended for Andrew's schooling. So Marianne was forced to move back to Illinois, where her elder children lived in 1995, and later went on to receive public assistance. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you about another guy named David Madsen. While Andrew was being kept by Norman, he would still go out with his younger crowd and try to hook up. He would leave town to go to San Diego or something, and he would tell Norman that he was actually going to visit his ex-wife and young daughter. Many of his friends didn't even know about Norman. One weekend in November 1995, Andrew was having dinner with friends at a restaurant in San Francisco when he noticed a cute, preppy blonde guy, David Madsen. David was so charismatic, and everybody said that there was like an instant spark between them. David was from Minneapolis, in town on business. He was an architect. He also liked to live a certain lifestyle like Andrew, but unlike Andrew, David worked really hard for it. He was very driven and dedicated, and he earned everything he had. He was an aerobic ski and swimming instructor. His father said that he taught half the kids in their hometown how to swim.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that adorable?
That is really cute.
But he was really attracted to Andrew's flashiness. David, like Andrew, liked to be the center of attention, but as a peacemaker, unlike Andrew. He had a thing for the underdog, and he was always trying to help people or uplift people. He was kind of drawn to people who needed him. Before meeting Andrew, David had a kind of traumatic relationship with a guy named Greg Nelson, who would end up stalking David. He spread false rumors that David had given him HIV, and he would call David as many as 120 times a day. He gave David's phone number to sex phone lines so people looking for action would call him.
Oh my God.
He even sent pornographic literature along with a nude picture of David to David's job at a law firm, sending him to the senior partners, saying, "Do you know what your employees do?"
Oh my gosh. Is revenge porn illegal in 1995?
Is it in 2022? Is it illegal yet?
Oh my God, I don't even know. I thought it was supposed to be.
Man. You like that tag group on Facebook that says, "First I ha-ha'd, then I sadded."
Yep, it's
so relatable. So this guy ended up harassing David for over 2 years. He was finally jailed after repeatedly violating a court order to stay away from David. David was literally afraid to open his front door, and he had to change his phone number numerous times. He never knew when he was going to walk outside and find his car all keyed up or something. And he absolutely hated violence. His father recalled taking him duck hunting once when they shot this duck, and he cried and cried so badly that his father tried to like hide the duck behind a tree, but like David wouldn't stop crying. So he took the duck and like gave it to a neighbor to make it go away.
It was me when I was little fishing. It was horrible.
It's just so fishing. Oh my God. But this is so wholesome, you know?
It is.
Like he took him duck hunting and he's just, oh. Anyway. There was also an incident when David was a dorm advisor. An angry student mistook him for somebody else and pushed him through a pane of glass. Oh, he was not injured. I keep waiting for your reaction, and then
I don't. I'm so delayed. I'm sorry.
Sorry. He was not injured, but of course he was really shaken up. And those seem like really good reasons to not be a fan of violence.
Yeah, I mean, for sure.
David also struggled with his sexuality. His family was religious and it was just really hard for them to grasp. But even so, when David came out to his father was basically like, I can't say I understand because I don't believe in that, but I don't love David any less or view him any differently. David tried to date girls and even fell in love with one woman. He teeter-tottered on whether he was straight or gay or bisexual, but he knew that he was attracted to men. So David and Andrew started a long-distance relationship. Andrew had to keep David a secret from Norman, and he had to keep Norman a secret from David. So because of this, Andrew could never leave David a phone number where he could call him. So David just had to wait around for Andrew to call him. Andrew would send him these cute letters and postcards from different places, but David was only allowed to write back to a post office that Andrew rarely checked. He told David that his family had to keep a low profile because there were potential kidnap victims. He was like super cryptic like that.
What the fuck? He's probably like, yeah, my dad was kidnapped and taken to the Philippines and now he lives on a dirt floor.
I know. Andrew and David would see each other every 2 or 3 weeks or so, but Andrew would also start hanging out at gay bathhouses where drugs were prevalent. Do you know what that is?
A bathhouse is like a spa.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Apparently it's like, they're like saunas and locker rooms and like showers and stuff. Yep. But apparently at these gay bathhouses, like, sex. You would pay for the services, like the shower. Yeah, but people would go there and like prostitute or sell drugs and stuff. And it was supposedly like discouraged by the owners, but they knew what it was. And there were people who would end up like living there, like spending 24/7 there.
Where do you sleep? On a facial bed?
Well, I'm kind of wondering if that's the thing. If these were like homeless people who would just like do crack to stay awake all the time and hang out there, you know, to not be in the street. I wonder, you know?
Yeah.
At least maybe I'm getting that impression because that's what it seems like Andrew does. He hangs out here when he's in between places.
Hmm.
Not just in between places. He does pop in and out to have sex.
Is he still doing porn while he is with Norman?
I don't think he was successful at doing porn. I think he tried to get into it, but he does like watch a lot of porn.
He's just a habitual masturbator.
So Andrew started to explore S&M and he planned to get David into it. However, he would tell all his friends that David was actually the one to introduce him to it. But before long, it became, David won't let me do everything I want to do. There was a dungeon master, like the sexy kind, who recalled Andrew kind of flirting with the idea of S&M, and he would come to him with questions about bondage and where to buy restraints and stuff. He even called him up and asked him about mixing semen with blood, like making a small incision into the chest or the arm and then ejaculating into it and mixing it.
Oh.
And even the dungeon master was like, it's very strange, and it's one way that HIV spreads.
Yeah, that's a good way. You just put it right in there.
Ew. A friend named John Semereau claimed that on more than one occasion, he had dinner with Andrew and David, and they both wanted him to engage in a threesome with them, which he never did. It seems like David was a consenting participant into these things, at least to an extent. He was said to have been seen going to these like themed leather nights and stuff at these clubs, but it did get to a point where he said that sex with Andrew was not just lousy. He said that it was uncomfortable and not enjoyable.
Oh.
He said that Andrew kept trying to do things that he did not want to do. And when David said no, Andrew stormed out of the hotel room and went down to a restaurant and threw a little tantrum. Another friend who talked to David said, I know on two occasions David talked to me about experiences with bondage and it really wasn't his thing. On a personal level, David was submissive in bed and he'd rather be manhandled than stroked. I'm a teddy bear at home and David would ask me to be more aggressive. You know what? Huh?
I just, yeah, I got confused by that.
So the guy is saying that like David was submissive in bed. He would rather be manhandled. Like this guy was like a big softy and David was like, can you be a little bit more aggressive? So what I'm thinking is that maybe David wasn't into S&M, but maybe that's why he flirted with it. Maybe he did like to be like roughed up a little bit and manhandled and kind of grabbed. And maybe that's why he experimented with going a little further.
Yeah, and then he realized that it was too much for him.
or at least Andrew was too much. You know, like I can imagine like you have to feel safe, and maybe he was legit scared with Andrew.
Right. Like he's going to cut me and come in me. That's.
Andrew had a friend named Doug Stubblefield who had done a college thesis on a homosexual philosopher who articulated going beyond the boundaries of normality. And Andrew went to him for advice on S&M videos to rent. Doug became concerned that Andrew was violating a fundamental tenet of the pain and pleasure principle, that it has to be equal and balanced. He got the impression that Andrew was having trouble drawing that line and that he was trying to dominate David too much.
Mm.
Another friend said that Andrew treated David like a slave. He would give David the car key and then bark, "Here, go get the car." With David having such a hard time maintaining contact with Andrew, he started to suspect that Andrew was seeing other people. Andrew was like, "Well, I never said that I would be exclusive when we've only been going out on a few dates." And David was like, "Okay, I guess that's fair." But David started to feel the lack of being pursued. It's like he's always chasing Andrew down. Andrew's never coming looking for him, you know?
Right. Hold on, let me let this cut out. Do you hear him?
Yeah.
Hold on. You're so cute.
One night, Andrew went to visit David and they ran into an old crush of Andrew's. He and David took a little walk and he warned David, "Andrew is a pathological liar. It's crazy. You don't know who he is. Don't put anything you're not prepared to lose in that basket." He said that David listened, but it seemed like he wasn't yet ready to let Andrew go. He said he was very commitment oriented, very Minnesota, very trustworthy and reliable. In July of 1996, Norman took Andrew to France, and Andrew, of course, blew through his allowance and then some. He decided that he should have a new Mercedes SL600 convertible that cost $125,000, and he gave Norman an ultimatum. He doesn't get him the car, he was going to leave.
Oh, okay.
And Norman was like, "Sorry." So Andrew ended up packing his bags and leaving a note saying, "I've moved on." But then he, like, shortly after that, called Norman and left him a voicemail with his new cell phone number. And he fully expected Norman to call him.
So he just had, like, a full man grown temper tantrum and left Europe.
Exactly. He couldn't have even, like, negotiated or asked for, like, a cheaper car or something. He was like, Mercedes or nothing.
Right. And it's in Europe. They have to, like, bring it back here. That's a lot.
And he fully expected Norman to crumble without him, and he did not. So Andrew ended up being forced to move into a weekly studio apartment rental. By now, Andrew had been promising David for months that they would spend the 4th of July together, but then he would send David a postcard saying, "I may not be able to come home in July." He implied that his family was involved in some kind of sinister activity. But anyway, the 4th of July came and went, and Andrew didn't come through, and David had finally had it. So he cut Andrew off. So now Andrew had absolutely nobody, because his sugar daddy just left him and his boyfriend just left him, and neither one of them knew that the other one existed to begin with. And now Andrew's all alone. So he wrote Norman a letter saying, "I'll let you decide how much palimony you want to give me to compensate for my year of service."
Palimony. Oh, the audacity.
Yeah. And Norman actually gave him $15,000, probably to be like, "Okay, now leave me alone." And then he took off to Europe with some new friends that he had met through Andrew. So he was probably like, "Fuck you, man. I'm going to go hang out with my friends and never talk to you again." When Andrew tried to deposit the money, he tried to convince the teller at the bank not to report it to the IRS, which is a requirement for any check over $10,000. But the teller refused. I'm surprised he didn't get caught right then and there.
Yeah, but I think those things take time.
And he was really charming. Like, he was a con artist. Like, he really was like inventing Anna.
Literally.
He's inventing Andrew.
I love it.
So now that Andrew lost Norman, he was desperate to get David back. But David was starting to get really shady vibes from Andrew. Andrew had once told him, "There's someone in prison right now who got my friends in trouble. I've arranged to have him killed."
Oh, there's someone in prison now who got my friends in trouble?
Yeah, so I think that David was starting to not only be like, "He doesn't have time for me anyway," but also like, "I don't know if I want to open up this can of worms, you know? I don't know if I want to ask about it."
Right.
So Andrew started to realize that he had lost both David and Norman, so he decided to set his sights on the one person he still had, Jeff Trail. Andrew told him that he was coming to visit him for a few days, but that visit stretched into 2 weeks. Andrew went and got his hair cropped to look just like Jeff's. He spent the whole day with Jeff's boyfriend, Daniel, and he went on and on about how David is the love of his life and how he's the man that he wants to marry. Daniel got the impression that he and David were in a loving, long-term relationship, which of course wasn't true. He also kept giving Daniel drinks and he brought him home drunk, which got Jeff like really angry. Jeff was getting fed up with Andrew at this point, and he actually called up Daniel's mother and told her to do anything she can to keep Daniel from getting mixed up with Andrew. So it's interesting, like Jeff has been defending Andrew this whole time, and now that he sees him like getting close to somebody that he loves, and he's like, we gotta protect people from Andrew now.
Right. Why the fuck did he cut his hair like Jeff's?
That's a good point. I'm not really sure I understand that. Maybe he was kind of infatuated with Jeff. I mean, Jeff kind of had everything he didn't, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I was kind of wondering if maybe he was trying to steal his boyfriend away.
It's either that or he's trying to pry in between them to get them to break up. So that he
it's weird. And maybe that's another reason why Jeff was angry that he brought his boyfriend home drunk, you know? Like maybe he was like, are you trying to take advantage of him?
Right. Yeah, that's weird.
Andrew was really feeling a sense of rejection now. He falls deeper and deeper into a crystal meth addiction.
Addiction.
And his appearance really started to suffer. His sense of self-worth was directly tied to the things that he had and the people he knew and the things that people would do for him. So if he wasn't accepted by wealthy people in high society, he really didn't know who he was. So he was completely lost. Jeff Trail ended up finding a job in Minneapolis, and Andrew saw this as an opportunity to call up David and ask for his help to show Jeff around. But like Jeff also didn't ask for this. Andrew would just kind of barge in unannounced and be like, okay, I'm here to show you around town. And then like always the trip would extend to like 2 weeks and Jeff was starting to get fed the fuck up. Jeff finally told Andrew, like, can you please just go check into a hotel or go home now?
You have overstayed your welcome. Thank you.
And this happened often with Jeff and David, and they just never had the heart to tell him. David was also super uncomfortable to have him barging in on his life. By now, David had a new boyfriend named Robbie, who was a tall, handsome black man. Andrew knew all about Robbie, but he still told David, I've changed. I'm becoming a better person, and I have you to thank for that. Mm-hmm. This was totally taking advantage of David's need to help the underdog. He couldn't not help somebody who was so wounded.
Right.
Andrew returned to Minneapolis in mid-November, and he attended a party that David and Robbie were throwing. The night before the party, Jeff and Andrew went to a bar where Andrew started talking to a guy named Joe. Andrew begged Joe to let him come home with him because he actually didn't have any place to stay, because now Jeff and David both have boyfriends at home. Andrew went home with Joe, and they went to bed together, but they immediately had an argument about who was going to be on top and who was going to be on bottom. Both of them were like, I am not a bottom. I don't like that. Apparently, Andrew spent the next 2 hours all over him, affectionately smothering him. But when Joe tried to touch him back, he would freak out and be like, no, don't touch me. And like, oops, I got excited. And like, push his hands away. So they never ended up having sex. But the next morning, Joe remembers waking up having to fight Andrew off of it. And he also had numerous hickeys on his neck. Andrew had also bitten him on the chest and left him ugly bruises.
Oh my God. Okay, I'm sorry, but who is Joe again? Is this a new person?
Some random guy that he met at a bar. He was okay. Hanging out with Jeff Trail, and I think he was just trying to find somebody to stay with.
Okay.
So he picked up a guy in the bar. And even though they didn't like each other, he spent the night there. And it's like he knows he's overstaying his welcome, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So Joe couldn't wait to get him the fuck out of his house. In the morning, he drove Andrew over to Jeff's house. Andrew told him that he was cold and he borrowed a jacket from Joe, which cost $1,200. Andrew just like took the jacket home with him. And like a few days later, Joe saw him out in the street wearing it. But he was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'll take the loss.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine loaning somebody a $1,200 jacket and just being like, I don't want to go anywhere near that guy?
Yeah. Like that bad. You don't want to go near him that bad that you won't even get back your over $1,000 jacket.
Right. So the night of the party, people noticed that Andrew's appearance had changed. He was wearing a nice suit, but it didn't quite fit him anymore. He was also a little bit like plump.
and he looked tired and worn down. Plus, his behavior was downright bizarre. First, he loaded up a plate with hors d'oeuvres and he fed them to the dog after Robbie, that's David's boyfriend, had explicitly told everybody not to feed any hors d'oeuvres to the dog. By the way, David's dog was a Dalmatian named Prince.
Aww.
Like Paw Prince.
Oh.
I know. I just love that. So the dog promptly threw up.
Good going, Andrew.
Then Andrew picked up a picture of Rob and David together and said, "This looks interesting." Like he was trying to get a reaction, but nobody ended up paying him any mind.
Oh my God.
Then he walked over to the table that had food on it and it had a couple of candles on it. And he nudged a paper plate towards the flame intentionally. A friend of Jeff and David's named Rick, like, saw this and he pulled the plate away. But Andrew, undeterred, then put some napkins on the plate and shoved it into the candle flame. And then he dropped the flaming plate on the table and just walked away as he heard the smoke alarm go off.
Oh.
Just for fun.
What the hell?
He's just like, hee-hee, and then walks away. So Rob grabbed the plate and then he went and held it under a faucet. And then after that, Andrew went and started rubbing up against David and like whispering in his ear, like flirting with him. So Rob finally grabs him and pulls him into a corner and just slammed him up against the wall and said, "Excuse me, I understand you're excessive. I'm not going to have you pressing up against my man. While I'm here, you respect my presence or you won't be here."
Ooh, go Rob.
And Rob is like a 6 foot tall black guy and gorgeous. So Andrew backed off saying, "All right, man, it was a whim." And David was like, "Oh my God, thank you," to his boyfriend, Rob.
He's like, "That's so hot."
Well, poor David, too. He's probably been trying for a long time to like be polite to Andrew while trying to like give him little hints that he's not interested, you know?
Right. It's like, and you look like shit. So
and he's aggressive.
Yeah.
After the party in an elevator, somebody actually turned to Andrew and said, "You are such an asshole." He was unaffected. Like we said, he knows he's staying his welcome or overstaying.
It's so weird to me. Like, I feel like there's people like this everywhere. Like, they just are like so like broken or something that they just are destructive everywhere they go.
And I think it's a little bit narcissism, too, that they just like take. And it's not that they don't think about anybody else. It's that they don't care.
Right.
Everybody else is irrelevant.
Right. It's so weird.
So Andrew started frequenting a bathhouse called the Mustang Spa, which was open 24 hours. And he started like living there, like how we talked about. The owner said that he didn't think Andrew was going in there to have sex, but rather just walking around annoying people, like telling them his outlandish stories. He was also maybe looking for clients to sell drugs to. He was often hanging out with a couple of junkies who were clearly using him just for his drugs because like he didn't fit in with them. Like they were like, they looked like druggies and he did not.
Right.
The owner had said, "People start living at the baths because they don't want to focus on what's going on in their lives." He said he kept a close eye on Andrew and ended up kicking him out when he became too much. Like, just being there and being shady and selling drugs, like, it just became too much.
Literally everybody around him sees him for who he is. It seems as though. It took a while.
And that's what's so interesting, like, the narcissistic part of him. It's like, he doesn't care if people don't believe him as long as they go along with it.
Right.
As long as they let him tell his stories. He doesn't care. Do you hear my child?
A little bit.
Okay. Sorry. She can't hear me, and that's the important thing. Andrew was delving more and more into violent sexual fantasies. He would see a cute boy walking down the street and say something like, "Oh, I'd love to electrocute him."
Oh my God.
Around February 1997, two separate bartenders noted independently that whenever anybody complained about somebody's behavior at the bar, Andrew would say, "Well, we'll just have to kill him."
Oh my God.
He's getting so creepy. David and Rob ended up breaking up, and David would soon get a new boyfriend named Cedric Rucker. He would kind of try to avoid hanging out with Andrew, but Andrew was always insisting or like offering some amazing trip or something. And David was kind of dazzled by it, and he kind of like just let him buy him stuff and like let him keep trying.
Anna.
It's sad, but David also liked living this nice life, you know? So right. Some people see it as David let him on or like used him.
This is like watching a scary movie. It's like a suspense movie is what it is.
So Dave is just like accepting all of these gifts and all the while telling him that he didn't want to be anything more than friends. They went on a trip to Los Angeles with a couple of other friends, and Andrew again tried to get David into bed with him, but David didn't let up. It was like David finally had a little bit of control over the relationship, and that just made Andrew's rage build.
Oh, God.
Andrew went back to San Francisco, and one night he met a 26-year-old guy named Tim Schwager.
Swagger.
At a dance club. So Andrew took him back to a fancy hotel, and Tim says that his memories about that night are hazy. He assumes that he might have drank too much, or he possibly might have even been drugged, just because of like how bad his recollection is.
Bill Cosby'd him.
Dun dun dun. So like Joe, Tim had memory flashbacks of trying to fight Andrew off of him during the night, and then woke up with 3 hickeys. He remembered going to sleep wearing underwear, but woke up completely nude.
Oh God, okay.
Before Andrew returned to Minneapolis for the final time, he stayed in San Francisco, clearly on drugs. He went out for the night and ran into some friends and was weirdly aggressive. Like, his friend said that he would come up behind them and pick them up and spin them around, or he would playfully put them into a chokehold that was like way too tight. His friends were straight up like, dude, you're hurting me or you're embarrassing me. Cause he would do that thing where he would like pick them up from behind and then like jump up and down when it looked like he was humping them. And these were grown ass adults.
Right.
In a bar. Andrew hung out with his old friend, Steven, and he told him about David and again talked about him like as if they were like a loving couple and made no mention of the fact that David had like already broken up with him and rejected him.
He's like living in this fantasy relationship with him still.
Mm-hmm. He's telling him things like, he's the man for me. And Steven asked him, why do you say that? Andrew's face contorted and he let out a loud manic laugh and said, well, he lets me do anything I want to him, and just started cracking up.
Oh my God. He didn't like it though, Andrew.
So Steven was like what? Like, what does he let you do to him? And Andrew was just like, oh, you know, cages, harnesses around the genitals, latex masks. And Steven was like, latex masks? Like, he was kind of freaked out by it. So Andrew was like, well, why don't you come back to the hotel with me? Like, kind of implying that they were going to try some of those things. And Steven was like, Andrew, we've been friends for 8 years. Don't you think this is kind of silly? And Andrew was just like, yeah, maybe you're right. So Steven, having known him for a long time, was kind of picking up on the fact that there was a different side of Andrew than he was used to seeing. Like, Andrew was always the life of the party. He was upbeat and happy. And now he seemed like weirdly unfulfilled and troubled.
Right. He seemed like the dark side of him.
Right. By April 1997, Andrew had racked up over $40,000 on 2 credit cards and was totally broke. He had filed for bankruptcy and got American Express to purchase a ticket to Minneapolis. Nobody knew at the time, but this was a one-way ticket. He began giving away all of his possessions and he told his friends that he had unfinished business with Jeff Trail.
Oh, no.
And that's where we're going to leave off for part one.
Run, Jeff, run.
So stay tuned for part two. Thanks again for listening. We hope you enjoyed the part one of the Gianni Versace story, Inventing Andrew. Just a heads up, we finally set up a Patreon with all of our episodes. For just $1 a month, you can support us and get exclusive access to behind the scenes footage. You will also get access to new episodes 48 hours before everybody else.
Yay!
Don't forget, you can also see my extensive notes for this episode on brokenlimelight.com, where you can also see photos and interviews. You can buy merchandise, leave a comment, et cetera, et cetera. And okay, thanks again, fam, for all of your support. We love you.
Love you guys. Bye.
Bye.
Barkbox, 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 Barkbox. You guys know my dogs, Jude and Eleanor Rigby. Well, we just started getting them BarkBox, and I'm telling you, your dogs will love you. No more are they angry at the mailman. No more, I say. It's like a box of dog joy that's delivered every month, and each box tells a different story with different themed toys, treats, and photo-worthy props. Typically, what we get in each box is a couple of toys, a couple of treats, and a chew, but you can actually tailor-fit your box to fit your dog's needs. Guys, I'm telling you, your dogs will love you, even more than they already do. So try it out, and if you use my link, you'll get a free extra month of BarkBox, which is a $35 value. So just head to BarkBox.com/BrokenLimelight and get started on your first BarkBox today. BarkBox! Bark box, bark box, bark box. Nailed it, Jude.